Hello and welcome to episode 101 of WB40, the weekly podcast with me, Matt Valentine, and Chris Weston. So we're into triple figures, 101. What happened to episode 100?
Well, that's a really good question, isn't it? Because we had episode 99 only last week, and now we're at 101. So we've gone off at right angles, haven't we? We've smashed out into another dimension.
Well, another medium. If you want episode 100, it's a written version. You can find it on the website at wb40podcast.com. We've got fabulous contributions from Ben Newton from Sumo Logic, from Tom Geraghty, who is a DevOps expert. Who else we got?
Mark Wilson.
Mark Wilson, yeah, who was a guest a few weeks ago.
And Mark Aikman, of course.
Mark Aikman, indeed. And Dr. Nancy Doyle, the neurodiversity expert. So that is a fabulous read. I think we got to about 15,000 words or something ridiculous in the end. It's like a quarter of a book.
Yeah, it's nearly there. It'll have to make its way into a book at some point.
One day. Maybe that's the episode 200. We actually do try to get the book next time. But fantastic thanks to everybody who took part in producing episode 100. But on with 101 as we enter into our second century.
Absolutely. 101, which means that we've only got 99 to go now before we can have an even bigger celebration and anniversary. I'm going to start preparing for it already.
In these times when you can't have any spontaneity at all because of the internet, I think it's probably for the best, hey? So what have we got on the show tonight? We've got the latest episode of I Must Read It Again, and we've got Andy Callow, who is talking about a book called Managing for Happiness by Jürgen Apollo. And then you went off and did an interview last week, which we've got out today, which is Who and What.
So it's a chap called Menno van Doorn, and he's a he works at Vint, which is part of Sagetti, and or Sagetti, I think they call themselves, and produces a whole bunch of interesting research, I've kept up with a lot of their output over the years. It's always thought provoking, and this time they're talking about a thing called the synthetic generation, which is about how we people coming into the workforce today are shaped differently by the media in which they see.
Quite timely, that. So that's coming up in a bit. But let's get on with it. Let's go and have a listen to what Andy's got to say about the book Managing for Happiness.
What is the name of the book?
The name of the book's called Managing for Happiness.
Who is the author?
Jürgen Apollo.
When did you first read the book?
I read it in 2017 as part of a book club that I started with the leadership team working on the national NHS website, NHS.uk, NHS Digital. It's a really great book to read as a group and collectively try stuff out and see what works, which is entirely in keeping with the agile approach.
Tell us briefly the main theme of the book.
Creating a happy work environment leads to productive, fulfilled teams. It also says that the environment we work in is so complex that no one can grasp it all. Not least the leader, and then needs a team-based approach. And certainly that command and control methods for managing teams is so inappropriate, and we need to change our way of thinking.
What impact has the book had on you?
It's really practical, it's really easy to read, and some things in it that I've used regularly when working with teams. Some simple things like giving people cards or notes to say thank you or a job well done, and a technique for giving feedback called the feedback wrap. And other techniques like working out levels of delegation using delegation poker cards, which is, you know, sort of turns awkward situations into fun.
When did you last read it?
So I've only read it the once in 2017 as part of the book club.
If you could describe the book as an animal, what animal would it be?
Perhaps a parrot that tells amusing agile related jokes.
Who are you?
My name's Andy Callow.
What do you do?
I'm the Programme Director for the NHS app at NHS Digital, but I'll be starting as the Chief Digital and Information Officer at Kettering General Hospital later this year. And it's on my list to read as a refresher before I start, along with another of Apollo's book, Management 3.0, and Nancy Klein's Time to Think, two other books that have had a big impact on me and my leadership journey in the last few years.
Well, thank you for that, Andy. fantastic as always, and we are always looking for people to propose their own books that they have shaped their thinking or have been influences on them throughout their career. So if you've got one and you want to do one of these little segments for us, then please do get in touch, because we'd love to have you.
So last week you went to go and see somebody from Sagetti, which is one of the parts of Capgemini, about a new report that they have published called The Synthetic Generation. Who, what, when, how?
Yeah, so as I said earlier, Menno van Doorn, he's been working at Sagetti for a long time and has produced a lot of different research reports looking into the future, trying to understand how we're going to work in future and those sort of things, which ties nicely really with the way this podcast works. So I asked him if he'd talk about this latest report that's coming out, which is about, as we say, the synthetic generation and what he means by that. And I started by asking him about this term, which essentially talks to the idea that today we see so much output from different types of media which can be manipulated and is potentially not true, and you've got, you know, a lot of the issues with fake news, etc. And I started by asking him about how that's different, and is it more important to change from the 1950s, when we had television that was going to corrupt our youth, and in the 1980s it was computer games. So 30 years on, is this the next moral panic, or is it a real issue?
I think basically it's because it's so different and massively used. It goes back to when we wrote Meet the Media 12 years ago. And we tried to catch it in the title of the book, Meet the Media. So what difference is that you are the broadcaster of basically yourself in your own life? And 12 years ago, that was, you know, when you ask people, are you on Twitter or do you know about Twitter, only a few would be a little bit knowledgeable. So it was, but in 12 years, it became massively adopted in society. And that's the change. So the adoption plus the, you know, the reality is that you are broadcasting yourself and looking at yourself, which is totally new.
Well, I guess that's true, and it's almost that those barriers to entry to being to broadcasting to untold numbers of people have fallen away, haven't they? So when you and I were younger, if we wanted to do that, you'd have to get on TV somehow. That'd have to be that was the only way. You know, you needed a TV studio to do that.
Some people used a radio, and you know, you could listen to old and talk to people at the other side of the world, but there were only a few people. And Meet the Media was, you know, we got a lot of comments on the title. People were saying, oh, they're so, it should be we, you know, because the internet will bring everybody together, and you know, we live in a village, McLuhan. But then we thought, okay, but isn't it all about me in the first place? But now I'm a little bit more optimistic about the me and the we. I think from this generation, when you look at all the research done, I would definitely say it's more a we generation than a me generation.
And is there something in that about the fact that when the world was a bigger place, if you know what I mean, in that we knew where we lived, we knew the people around us, we also knew a wider circle of people, and we could conceptualize that, and we also knew that there were however many billion of people there were in the world, but it's a little bit like the size of the universe. You don't really have to conceptualize it. You just have to understand that it's a big number and they're all out there. But now we see these people, the endless streams of people that float past our Twitter timelines and appear on our Facebook pages as friends of friends of friends or whatever. And you know, I think I saw a stat, and I can't remember the number. I think it was something like 21,000 podcasts created in 2017 or something. So or maybe it was 210,000. It was an enormous number of podcasts created. So is this people kind of seeing how many people suddenly having to conceptualize all these different individuals and trying to assert their own personality and say, look, I'm here as well.
Yeah, I mean, my father is from the silent generation, born in 1935. And he's written a piece of the first 15 years of his life. He gave it to me. And it was shockingly, without any media at all. There was there was radio, and there was something called distributed radio. So you could have your neighbors listen to your radio, etc. But it was such a small world. And now we are not only connected to the rest of the world, we're also sort of competing with your life. It's a game. It became a game of itself. It's difficult to say that technology itself and the new media itself shaped this generation per se. There's a lot of other stuff going on, but if you look at the technology and if you look at the part of the stress and the anxiety under the youngest generation, it's also because they feel the pressure of competition. I would say. Part of it coming from media, part of it coming from other things going on.
Yeah, and I guess that that feeds into some of the fake stuff that we'll sort of come to in terms of how people present themselves is the most idealized version, isn't it? That's the Facebook. Style is to produce all of the great things about your life in order to make other people envious that they're not you.
I'm not sure that it's the motivation to have people envy you. I'm not sure. I mean, and there's a lot of young people that want to show the ugly side of themselves or the ugly side of life, etc. The thing I'm fascinated about is that they all crave authenticity, and this is quite something, because when you look at this new media and talk about authenticity, you and I would say probably this is not authentic. You know, this is playing with your own image, etc. But on the other hand, if you see that authenticity in self, or let's call it the grip on reality in society, is lost, then you can probably better understand why they are craving for authenticity. Because if the world itself, with all the fake news that you mentioned and alternative facts and all these things happen during your formative years, I would say it's quite obvious that you turn your face from the real reality or the fake reality world and listen to each other. So
yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, that's a good point.
And for me, it was the hardest to understand, because I'm not of that generation. And normally, the definition of what it makes a generation is what you assume to be normal, and others assume to be abnormal. So what they're doing, I would say, okay, there's quite a lot of stuff that's abnormal, but for them, it's normal. So it is. Part of what shapes this generation, listening to each other, being influenced by each other, follow each other, being followed, and that's all already happening in your formative years. So followership is embodied in this generation. Companies talk about leadership, but they have followership in their DNA.
That's another really interesting point. So how do you think that affects that people work in the future? Because I'm sure we've all seen this change in, especially people involved in technology, that once upon a time when you went to work, especially if you went to work for a big company, your network that you built in your career or in your work life was pretty vertical. It was within your company and then with a few others that were kind of aligned, because those are the people that you were talking to. Whereas now, and I think this happens across all professions, but certainly very much in tech, where your network is very flat. You are networked socially through the technology with people who are involved in your discipline, whether it's PHP or whether you're a C# coder or whether you're a hardware engineer or whatever it might be. You are always talking to and sharing ideas with people in that discipline, and it's not necessarily the vertical network isn't quite so important.
Yeah,
and that plays into what you're saying, doesn't it, about how that followership is important to people who have lived in this way.
Yeah, we use the word post hierarchy, not saying that they are not hierarchical, because they are. That's what they do constantly every day on social media, saying who's your friend and who's not. But it goes in networks. And when you look at, you know, your career and your working life and what will change or what is already changing, is that the way that they look at hierarchies is totally different. And especially when you look to the older generations, let's call them the maybe in power in organizations, so the baby boomers possibly, or Gen X, and they're disconnected with the baby boomers, because they have a sort of authority relationship. I mean, they believe in a top-down, vertical, traditional values hierarchy, and they are almost the opposite. So if you talk about culture clash, there's a culture clash, not between this generation and their parents, but this generation and especially the baby boomers, who are in power of corporations.
Yeah, and that comes back to a point that you made when we spoke the other day about digital transformations are happening all in every walk of life, in every company. But the people running the digital transformations are often either in that baby boomer generation or in the subsequent generation, and the digital natives are merely subject to it.
Yeah, it makes you wonder, what are they transforming to? I mean, what's the end point? I don't have a clue. I mean, we're talking about this generation, so almost one third of the world population. If you add the millennials, that's 63% of the world population. And people in charge are again, they're the baby boomers, and they're transforming corporation. And do they have any notion of what is going on in this generation? And are they heading towards the right direction of the transformation? You could seriously doubt that.
And if this generation comes through the ranks and engages with the existing hierarchies and becomes managers and leaders, how will that change then in terms of what do you think that will do to organizations?
I think good chance that it will take their corporations, their organization, into a new direction, which is one part of their character. You can give it different names, post-materialistic, or they're called the woke generation. So the purpose in organization that has been lost for many years. It was, when I entered the organization, at the time that I tried to make a career, they would say, okay, you can have this big, you can have a big car and a big salary, and that was it. And now you need to show what kind of purpose your organization is, and what kind of good you do to the world, and how your ethical standards are, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So them being in charge, probably first the millennials will be in charge, because they are older and they are sort of alike, and they will immediately connect to this younger generation because they're good friends, so to say.
Yeah, that's very true. There's always a gradual, there's no dividing line, is there, between generations where they suddenly change. It is a gradual shift in attitudes. I wonder though whether corporate structures are too rigid for these people to change them.
Could be. Well, that's not a problem. They will organize themselves in other corporates. That's one possibility. Organizations die and other flourish. And it needs to be like that. So either they change the corporations from within, or they create new organizations, whatever. It's not, of course, if you are a big corporate and you are not flexible, then you might have some issues. Of course, I understand that. But you know, in general, I think it's quite okay for new organizations to rise, specifically if they have those new values within. And it's gradual, as you, so the measurement of the changing value system is done in two decades already. And they show that each generation is a little bit more post-materialistic, a little bit more new values, a little bit more. So this generation definitely is totally different than the older generations, but the millennials were already on that same track, on the track of purpose and the wokeness, whatever you call it.
And I wonder how much of that is down to the fact that it's possible to be that sort of baby boomer generation, especially in the United States, came from a time of almost unimaginable wealth, really, that they went through in those kind of years from the 30s to the 50s, didn't they, in terms of the kind of things that a normal family would expect to have.
Mm-hmm.
And is that an ever increasing kind of line? Will the kind of things that are going on in the world now around energy and migration and climate change, will that force us to be a little less we'll have less chance to indulge ourselves potentially? Do you think something that this kind of woke generation is looking at?
I think yes, definitely the woke generation is looking at it. And when you look at the US and the big brands like Nike or Axe, Björnborg, Pepsi, and their commercials, it's quite interesting to see those woke messages, like the Colin Kaepernick believe in something from Nike, the switch towards diversity and gender fluidity, all these kind of things. And then they are massively backed by those big brands and their advertisement power. And there you have, from the bottom up, from the influencers, the same message. And I think this is really strong, because we're all living in this media, in a world of full of media. But now, if you watch all those commercials, it will definitely have an impact. So it's already going on. It's not something, you know, you don't wait until the new generation is entering your organization. You can see a lot of things happening from different stakeholders already.
Yeah, it is still a battle, though, isn't it? Because when you look at the things that are going on in America with Trump and his base seems to be very strong, no matter how he behaves or how evidence mounts against him, but there's a lot of very, very strong support for him regardless. You look at the what's going on in Europe and especially in the UK with Brexit. This is almost an counterpoint, isn't it? It's an anti-woke movement.
Yeah, it's a generation clash. And this is the clash that we were talking about, not between this generation and their parents, but this generation and older generations and older values, the traditional values, especially the baby boomers. We could go too much in detail. We talk about the Strauss-Howe theory, but I would advise any of your listeners to Google it, Strauss-Howe theory, and read the book Generations from 1991. There were some interesting views on, you know, how specifically baby boomers will change the world after 1991, that they written the book. So I would say, going back to the new generation, I mean, and the millennials, they are different. They are changing the world already, but the clash that we are experiencing is another one, the baby boomers.
Okay. I mean, it's definitely going on, isn't it? And I guess that clash between those generations will continue. But there's one thing for certain, is the younger generation has to win eventually, doesn't it? Because the other guys die.
Yeah. And I mean, it's of course, everyone knows, I mean, we're talking about technology, but I mean, you and I, we're all shaped by our parents. So if you look at who shaped the baby boomers, who shaped me, I'm a Gen X, who shaped this generation, the millennials, look at their parents. So the millennials were a product of the helicopter parents. And, you know, they were safeguarded by the parents and unlike me, I would say, I have lovely parents, but they weren't helicopter parents. And this new generation, I would say their parents are even, I would say, let's use the word worse in that respect. So they were raised with, you know, the notion of something in your food not being good for you, or plastic in your toy, you know, all these things are imprinted in your brain. And then at the certain moment when you grow older, you look around in the world and you see all these products still being there. And then you get the idea, let's do something about it. I mean, that's not far-fetched. I mean, this is not hocus-pocus theory. This is, you know, coming from the relationship of how your parents shape you. And I thought we need to mention this because, and we can go back to technology because I'm a tech, you know, watcher. And but still, I think the parents have a lot of influence, and you can understand this generation better when you look at the parents.
Yeah, I guess that's true. We all have our we're all shaped by our environment and our parents to some extent, aren't we? And I guess that defines the kind of problems that we're trying to solve, especially in a technological sense. It defines what's important and what the priorities are around solving those problems.
Yeah, so there are two theories. One is technology shapes you as a person. We talked about that. Probably that's very likely, difficult to prove. And the other one is the way you use technology is an expression of your identity and your DNA and of this generation. And if you take that approach and then look at what they're doing, they're influencing, they're mukbanging, I mean, they're eating in front of a camera, they do ASMR, whispering, sort of meditation, they do all these kind of things as an expression of their character, which I think is very relevant and very interesting to see. So that it shows that they are seeking for connection and relationships through the media. And there is so there's a wording, it's called then meta-modern, or easier to explain, neo-romantic. So it shows a sort of romantic spirit or neo-romantic spirit, because on the one hand, you know, it's quite hilarious to see that you want to eat in front of a camera, to be honest. Okay, you can laugh about it. Watch those movies, just type in mukbang and you're hooked for an hour or so. but I mean, on the other hand, it's also a way to connect and to, you know, we are eating with our friends and or with your spouse or your family, and they are also doing it in a digital way. And I think that's more than just fun. It shows something that they're looking for. Call it authenticity, call it synthetic feelings, or, you know, parasocial friendship. There's all this scientific labeling, but it actually shows who they are if you look at their media behavior.
Yeah, I guess. And I guess there's also that there's that escape route, which has always been, whether it was escapism, we're going back to the original conversation, escapism through watching TV, and when that was new, and when it was the kind of dominant entertainment medium.
Yeah.
Television was a way to go different places you'd never seen, and to live in those worlds. And the same with computer games. I guess we're getting now to the point, and I saw something in your research about the amount of 17-year-olds who have tried alcohol, for example, having dropped quite significantly. And why do people take drugs of any kind, really? It's often escapism. It's, you know, it's leaving the kind of day-to-day world behind. And if there is a if there's a chance to use alternative realities and like this kind of fake reality, if that's a term that's not too offensive to everybody. I feel quite offended that I've used it myself. You know, is it simply escapism, or is it deeper than that?
That's funny, you do it. I mean, I would just say watch out, because they're easily offended, you know, this generation. They're so should apologize already.
Sorry.
So the figures show that they are well behaved. So let's start over there. Well behaved, less alcohol and drugs. And you could say, okay, I was raised by watching Dallas, and I saw Bobby drinking whiskey all the time, you know, during daytime. That was my normal, you know, and then,
yeah.
So there, but, you know, going back to the parents of this new generation, escapism, of course, is like gaming and doing all these kind of things, and addiction to the media could be seen as an alternative of either being violent or being addicted to other drugs. Yes. Yeah. Well, again, it's difficult to prove all these things. The only thing you can say is that on the one hand, you see this going down, and on the other hand, you see a new life. Let's call it on life, you know, a different blend, a sort of, you know, of reality and media use and your own life. And there's no distinction anymore between those. That's why we call them the synthetic generation. But of course, it is an alternative. Anyone who played a game knows how, you know, Candy Crush or whatever, knows if there's an addiction. But this is different, because a lot of these users of media is really also connecting to other people. It's not you. I was doing games in my time, but I couldn't connect to anyone, and I was quite addicted to Tetris. Stupid game, by the way, but I was quite good at it.
Well, it was a good enough game to get a lot of people hooked, you know.
Yeah. I stopped when I went to a museum and I looked at all these paintings, and I thought, okay, if I ever use this, if I could imagine a Tetris block going down here and then turn it that way, and then I stopped. but no, I think it's an interesting question you raised, and of course, there's more than only the alternative for other addictions. That would be quite a negative, you know, a dystopian view on this generation.
Yeah, probably best not to dwell too much on that one.
No. part of it could be true. Yes.
What about then in terms of the future? Because we've seen quite incredible, I guess what you call it, image manipulation. There's the film that's coming out next month. There's the Marvel film, Captain Marvel, and I think it's the first film where an actor is, the term they use is de-aged throughout the whole film. So Samuel L. Jackson is in it, and he's going to be essentially a 30-odd-year-old Samuel L. Jackson, and that's all through machine learning, digital manipulation, and it starts to really make you question what are you seeing in front of your own eyes. So, and that's today. So, give it a year, 2 years, 5 years, things are going to change even more, aren't they? Where do you see this going, Mena?
Well, yes, it's I wouldn't say it's a $1 billion question, but it's easy to explain from, you know, when you just take technology, it's easy. Then you can say, okay, the ability of technology to play with reality seems almost endless now. From voice technology, Lyrebird, or video manipulation. I mean, all these technologies enables us to create alternative worlds or de-aging. And as with any technology, it can be used for the good and for bad things. And when you take the bad things and you realize nowadays that we are living in a world of alternative facts, fake news, you can easily write your own horror science fiction future, because if all these technologies will be used by almost everyone, because it's, you know, it's ubiquitous, it's becoming ubiquitous. How can we ever distinguish reality with fantasy or all these fake things? I mean, from that respect, going back from media that we've done in 12 years ago towards, and there we talked about hyper-realities, and there were a lot of ideas around creating hyper-realities. But you could say now we have the tools. Now we can create hyper-realities. And from AI perspective, if you have seen any of the latest stuff coming from NVIDIA, their synthetic media, a synthetic data generator, which enables us to create humans, faces of humans that you can't distinguish from real. You can't say this is made by a computer and this is a picture of a human. And it's so, so good. I mean, the quality is amazing. So then the question is, where does it end? You know, it doesn't.
Yeah, because
that's the answer.
No, I think that's right. Even on the video conferencing, if you use Zoom, there is an option. You can replace the background that if you've got a nice plain background, you can replace it with a picture. Okay, and that's a fairly trivial and it's a little toy feature. But there's also I can't remember what the feature is, but there's kind of beautification which might, I don't know, remove the bags from under your eyes or whatever it might be. Make you look like you've had a shave that morning or something. You know, I don't think it works. When I click the button, nothing happens. I don't think it's man enough to deal with me yet. But the even that, it's kind of small beer and it's trivial, but it makes us question what we're looking at, doesn't it? It makes us question: yeah. Am I looking at something that's real or not?
Yes, and going back to the generation, you could argue they are better prepared for that future, or you could say they are preparing themselves for that future because they already live in this synthesized media world much more than other generations. And that could be an optimistic approach, a positive future because, you know, they are well behaved, you know, all these things. They want to make something of the world. They are looking for purpose. They're not a punk generation. They're not looking for, you know, they're not the Johnny Rottens. So their use of the technology much likely is going to be on the positive side at the end, if you balance it. And, you know, I wouldn't say that, well, it goes back to the baby boomers. Maybe the baby boomers are, you know, when they are in power and they are, their use of that technology could take it to the negative side, but that's, you know, futurism is, you know, you're allowed to say anything about it because we cannot predict the future. That's the fun part of it, but we can imagine that this generation is already a little bit ahead of things. That's how I'd like to see it. They're in their DNA. There's more of the future than in the other generations. That's why I like it so much to talk about these generations from all these perspectives and then trying to figure out what's going on.
Well, I guess we'll have a ringside seat to find out how that happens as they look after us in our old age. We can try to see what they make of it all.
Yeah, so let's go back and have a conversation. Let's have a conversation in 10 years and then listen to all these things. But no, you can't predict, and that's a good thing. But you can look at the direction technology can take us, which is definitely towards a synthetic media future, which will bring a lot of good things from fantastic Hollywood movies to advertisements and maybe even, you know, spend your holiday in a virtual game, these kind of things. But playing with reality itself is also a danger, of course. And that's something we are aware of, or became aware of, or are aware of already, of course, because of all these fake realities of today.
Well, a big thank you to Menno for making the time to have a chat with us. It feels quite timely, this, given the current hysteria that appears to have taken over the parents of the country in the light of the Momo hoax, I think is the only fair way to describe it. There's a fantastic explainer on Wired that I'll put a link to on the webpage if you want to find out more about Momo. One of the things that's made me think quite strongly is actually one of the issues that we've got here isn't about technology, it's about media literacy. And if I think back, I studied sociology as my major. Quite a lot of that was mass media and communications, which is the sort of stuff that would be lumped under media studies. And in the 90s, and I think since, and still to this day, that's been a whole swathe of academia that's been utterly derided. I blame Maureen Lipman for that bloody BT advert back in the late 80s. And that actually we don't have good media literacy in this country. And by that, I mean people understanding of how media works. And I don't think we have good understanding of traditional media. And I don't therefore think that we have good understanding of any of this new stuff either. And that's about how we impart knowledge and skills and meta skills to people more than it is about any of the particular technologies that are rising. Because I don't think people understood TV. When you and I were growing up, we were told not to sit too close to it and watch too much of it because our eyes would go square. Which is obviously utter bobbins. And if I look at, we had the weekly newsletter coming out of the school on Friday, and they were telling us that the only good advice was to not talk to our children about any of this stuff and mention it by name. We should talk to them about feeling safe online, but we shouldn't talk about Momo specifically. Well, they're all talking about it. And if we're not actually addressing it up front, if we're doing it through, you know, weird metaphor, then we're not doing our jobs as parents, quite frankly. But of course, nobody understands what any of this stuff is. So I don't know. I feel there's some definitely weird stuff going on. The ability for moral panics to be able to emerge at a drop of a hat now is terrifying. But we don't have people who understand what they're doing, and we've got people who will act upon things because they're stupid, in the way that we've always had things like chain letters as well.
I think that's a fair point. This whole issue, whether we're talking about the synthetic generation that Menno describes in his report, or the kind of digital manipulation that goes on now with things like deep fakes and all this kind of thing, where you can see President Obama reading out words that he never spoke, all of this kind of thing has various psychological, sociological, and technological aspects to it, doesn't it? That we always seem to struggle with the deeper parts of it. So if you think back to, do you remember the Jason and the Argonauts type movies when you were a kid with the Ray Harryhausen stop motion stuff, and then you go back even to the original sort of King Kong movies with the enormous sort of stop motion gorilla, and people would run out of cinemas, you know, terrified at this thing back then, and people would be amazed and awestruck by Ray Harryhausen's work in those films in the 70s and 60s. And now you say, well, that's a bit rubbish, really. It's just a plasticine thing that, you know, clearly isn't real. But it takes some time for people to get to that stage. The younger you are, I think, the more you accept it. And I think people who are young
if you take Harryhausen's stuff, yeah, the, you know, the Jason and the Argonauts skeletons look utterly unbelievable to us now because we are used to computer generated graphics.
Yeah, it's more sophisticated.
Can you tell me the last time you saw CGI being used in a film? And I'd wager that you can't.
Absolutely.
That's exactly the point I'm making.
Yeah. That's exactly the point I'm making. I'm saying as we become more sophisticated, we tend to recognise things more quickly. So I think that... So you look at the Captain Marvel film that's out, I think this week or next week, where Samuel L. Jackson is de-aged through the whole film. So you've got Samuel L. Jackson, but you're going to be watching somebody who's ostensibly 30-odd years of age in the film rather than 60-odd that he is now. That is something that we would find hard to spot, But I suspect that people will get better at spotting that because it will become more clear to them that it's happening. That's the point I'm trying to make, that we learn how to discern reality from artifice through our understanding of the technology. And when these things are first introduced, such as Ray Harryhausen or King Kong or CGI on Doctor Who, whatever it was, where children would hide behind the sofa, then it seems more real then because it's new and it's novel. So we have the new generation won't be so impressed. They will find ways to spot or to be aware of what's going on, and therefore maybe some of this concern around what's real and what's fake will be mitigated just by those sociological changes.
So there's what's real and what's fake, and I think then the other element is what is to use a sociological term, hyper real. So I think still people of our generation and older, whilst we might actually in our actions not demonstrate this now as much, but people still think about real world and virtual world. We talk about, you know, the thing that you do in Facebook or in WhatsApp as being not real, video conferencing being not real, but being face to face with somebody in the same room is real, and all of that sort of in air quotes. And of course, the reality now is that the reality spans into digital realm. That the conversation you and I are having at the moment, which is being mediated by some clever technology, that means that you're in your place up in the West Midlands and I'm down in my place on the outskirts of London. This is no less real a conversation than if we were sitting in a place halfway between the two of us in Oxford, maybe.
No,
it's all real.
That's true. But even so, if you take Zoom, for example, even on Zoom, there's a button which is not man enough to do anything with me, but there's a button that says, I don't know what it says. It says, but essentially it says, tidy me up. There's a, which is meant to make you look slightly more presentable to the people you're talking to. And there's the kind of.
And the background blur, yeah, and the background, yeah, green screen thing.
Absolutely.
And yeah, no, I think actually those are really interesting. I think that those, we might have talked about this in the show before, but that for me, I think there should be much more panic going on around. I find that much scarier than some scary image that's not a real challenge going around and scaring the living daylights out of uninformed parents. The idea that we are now allowing technologies that will willfully change perceptions of reality and nobody is saying this is the slippery slope, I find really curious.
It's interesting, but I think it also leads to people will just say, well, whatever's on that screen, I'm going to assume that it's manipulated in some way. So the idea that you could have evidence presented in court that's a video of somebody doing something will become preposterous. It won't be accepted because it will become so easy to create something. So unless you've got some other way of time stamping or forensically being able to identify that this was an actual image recorded by an actual camera at an actual time and has not been changed in between, it would just become inadmissible simply because of the options to manipulate it. So things just change.
Yeah, there's an interesting thing out of that then, that actually these sorts of technologies might mean that it will stop being so surveilled. Because actually, you know, again, things like dash cams in cars, I just think are the sign that we've given up trust in strangers, which I find terrifying. But if it's so easy to be able to fake video footage, actually the value of having video cameras everywhere will diminish, which becomes then an interesting.
That sounds like the people, you know, complaining that you can't leave your front door open anymore.
Well, you can. It's just your insurance won't work.
It's a lot better in the old days because you could leave your front door open and we didn't have to have dash cams. The reason dash cams exist is because the technology exists that makes them cheap enough.
Yeah. That's
a fair point. We will always do what we can to try to protect ourselves and to stop ourselves being taken for a ride, because at the end of the day, if you happen to be somebody who is generally nice and pleasant and wants to help people, you also know that you will be taken for a ride if you're not careful. You have to build those defence mechanisms, don't you?
Well, fair enough. Thank you to Menno again for taking time to be able to be interviewed. We'll put a link on the website to, I think the whole report should be available by now. So
I think so.
So we shuffle towards the end of episode 101. What's happening for you between now and episode 102, seeing as there is nothing in life now other than increasing incremental episodes of this show for us?
That's right. That's all there is to look forward to, is ever increasing numbers. I think shuffling forward is probably the apt term, given that we're at our advanced age at this point. So I've got a piece of us. I'm going down to Oxfordshire to work with a company on their IT transformation, which is excellent. I'm really looking forward to that. And I am also continuing to work on another on various other things in the meantime. So yeah, it's a really busy week, but very enjoyable stuff coming up, I'm sure. How about yourself?
Various bits and bobs, including, of course, actually further conversations on our new venture podcast powered projects.
Gosh, yes.
Which we are still in vaguely stealth mode, but looks like we have our first client, which is brilliant. You'll be able to find out more about that at podcastpoweredprojects.com when we see fit to be able to publish more on there than just a picture and a link to a Twitter account, which is where it is at the moment. Stealth mode.
Yeah, that's a start. I like the picture. It's a nice picture.
So on next week's show, you can hear an interview with Jude Jennison, who is a fascinating management consultant type person, but her management consultancy involves five big old horses. And it was a fascinating chat I had with her a few weeks ago. You'll be able to hear it on the show next week, along with the usual rambling. You can follow us at WB40Podcast on Twitter. You can find our website at WB40Podcast.com. And you can subscribe to the show on all good podcasting platforms, Stitcher, iTunes, Spotify, and all the rest. Just search for WB40.